This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, May 21st. Let's start with the front page. Today we have a music education column headlined Teaching Grammy Incredible Thing. And we have a photo of the Sullivan School District's Interim Director of Bands, Chris Keneally of Mattoon, posing for a photo Monday, May 19th in the band room, while completing his year in this role. He's a quarter-finalist for the 2026 Grammy Award for Music Educator. Mattoon native talks award nomination, reflects on year with Sullivan Band. From Rob Stroud in Sullivan. High school principal Daniel Allen said he had been afraid that Sullivan's band program would be unsustainable after the loss of its beloved director, Aaron Jones, in an August 5th car crash just before the start of the new academic year. The Sullivan School District subsequently asked music instructor Chris Keneally, who assists the Arcola and Mattoon marching bands, to serve as interim director. Allen said the Mattoon native got Sullivan High School's band ready for football season, helped them commemorate Jones on senior night, and led them to a successful return to marching band competition after a long absence. He said Keneally also had grown participation in the band program. He has gone above and beyond to make sure to provide the students with every opportunity. We quite frankly worried they might miss out on, Allen said. What he did with the band this year was not short of amazing. Considering these accomplishments, Allen said he is glad Keneally recently has received a well-deserved nomination as a quarter-finalist for the 2026 Grammy Award for Music Educators. The semifinalists will be announced in September. The winner will be honored during Grammy Week in 2026 ahead of the award show. This award recognizes teachers who have made a significant contribution to music education and demonstrate a commitment to the cause of maintaining music education in schools. Keneally said he does not know who nominated him for the Grammy, adding that he was surprised when he received the notification letter in the mail. The music teacher said he is appreciative and honored to receive this recognition. There are no words, Keneally said. It's an incredible thing to be acknowledged like that. Keneally said he would be happy just to be a quarter finalist, but is hopeful that he might advance because of the potential for helping the Sullivan School District. The award winner would be flown to Los Angeles to attend the 2026 Grammys and related events. The 9 additional finalists will receive a $1,000 honorarium, and the schools of all 10 finalists will receive matching grants. 15 semifinalists will receive $500 honorarium with matching school grants. Keneally, whose last day of instruction is Wednesday, May 21st, said his year in Sullivan has flown by. Keneally said he has already had experience writing field music and directing marching band drum lines, but his time there has given him a behind-the-scenes look at all the work done by certified music teachers. I just have a huge respect for teachers. They do a lot, Keneally said. Sullivan's band program, which serves students in grades 6 through 12th, is now set to be directed by Ian Kinkley, who has been teaching band for Stewart's in Strasbourg. Principal Allen said Kinkley has been teaching since 2007 and has a doctorate in K through 12 education administration from Michigan State University. Allen said Kinkley will inherit a Sullivan High School band that is slated to grow from 22 to more than 30 musicians in 25-26, following Keneally's tenure. I am very happy with the opportunities our students were afforded because of his work ethic and his genuine care for the students and love for music and the band, Allen said. Keneally, who plans to continue supporting Sullivan as needed, said he has been excited to hear his students there talking about their love of music in the hallways and outside of school. The outgoing interim director said he was overjoyed to be able to include some of his younger musicians in pep band performances during the basketball season and bring all of his grade levels together, more than 90 musicians in total, for a May 7th concert to end the academic year. We are a family. We are one tribe, Keneally said, of Sullivan's school motto. We do this all together. Now our court column from Tony Reed in Decatur. Case against Heritage move stalls. St. Teresa's motion, seen as speculative. School plans to bolster complaint. A judge has rejected, for now at least, St. Teresa High School's attempt to seek an injunction to block Heritage Behavioral Health Center's plans to become its new neighbor. The 112-year-old Catholic school claimed Heritage's mix of patients with mental health and substance abuse conditions posed a danger to the safety of its more than 230 students. St. Teresa also alleged it would be damaged financially because fearful fee-paying parents would refuse to send their children there. But Macon County Circuit Court Judge Phoebe Bowers granted a motion by Heritage to dismiss the school's legal complaint in a decision that was announced Monday. In her ruling, the judge, who had heard verbal arguments May 14th, said St. Teresa had failed to establish a case in law for blocking Heritage's planned $43 million project to remodel the former Northgate Mall as a massively expanded treatment facility next door to the school's North Water Street campus. The allegations that plaintiff has a right that is in need of protection from defendant are vague, conclusory, and speculative, and without factual support, the judge said. She dismissed legal arguments by the school that, aside from claimed safety concerns, the arrival of Heritage also represented an invasion that would harm the school financially. There are no factual allegations that plaintiff will suffer irreparable harm, just conclusory and speculative statements that the threatened invasions will chill private donations and may reduce tuition revenues, Bowers said. Because plaintiff has not alleged facts sufficient to state a cause of action for permanent injunctive relief, the defendant's motion is granted without prejudice. This legal language opens the way for St. Teresa to come back and try again for an injunction, and the school has already said that is exactly what it will do. Mary Garrison, Heritage president and CEO, welcomed the judge's ruling as wonderful news when informed by the Herald and Review on Monday. "I'm glad to hear that, and our whole focus is to move forward with this project and continue to serve the community," she said. Garrison, who was in court for the May 14 hearing and heard Heritage clients described as predators who must be kept away from student prey, said she hoped there was still a chance to mend fences between the two sides. "There were some very difficult things to hear on how individuals we serve were characterized," she added, "but we will move forward and take the high road and make sure we are good partners in the community." Garrison said there is still much preparation and planning to go, along with detailed bidding plans for the giant construction project that she said will employ local labor. "We are looking at about 3 years," she said, when asked when the new facility is expected to be open and treating patients. For its part, St. Teresa insists it has only just begun to fight. Decatur attorney Gerald J. H. Stocks, representing the school, rejected any reading of the judge's decision as being soundly dismissive of the school's arguments. "I don't interpret it that way at all, not at all," he told the Herald and Review. "All she," the judge, "is saying is please submit some more evidence. So we'll have no issue in doing that. And we can really load it up. And while we certainly think there were sufficient facts alleged to survive the motion to dismiss, we have no shortage of facts that we can add to the complaint to bolster it, and we certainly will do so. As for any hope of forging a compromise with Heritage out of court," Stock said St. Teresa has been the party consistently reaching out with alternative solutions and being rejected. "They portray St. Teresa as the entity that is not willing to talk, and I want to underscore it is and has been Heritage that has refused to talk," he said. Stock said the school and wealthy friends of the campus have come up with everything from alternative sites to even offering financial assistance to buy other locations. "But they," Heritage, "won't sit down to even initiate a discussion," Stocks added. St. Teresa now has 28 days to file its amended complaint with the judge, and then Heritage's lawyer, Lisa Petrilli, will have 28 days to file a response. From Tony Reed in Decatur, mystery surrounds hurt delivery driver. Police are having a tough time figuring out the mystery of how a Decatur delivery driver was shot and wounded in the hand by some kind of weapon. Detective Sergeant Benjamin Massey said the 48-year-old driver had just finished making a delivery in the 2200 block of East William Street around lunchtime Monday when he was hit. He said he just got done and was walking back to his vehicle when he felt something hit his hand, said Massey. When he looked down and pulled off his glove, he found his hand was bleeding and believed he had been shot. The driver was seen at Decatur Memorial Hospital by patrol officers who noted the puncture wound. The injury was the size of like a BB or potentially a small caliber firearm injury, Massey added. The driver said he had no idea where the shot had come from, and Massey said police canvassed the 2200 block of East William searching for a crime scene but came up empty. And they spoke to multiple residents in the area who did not hear any gunshot, he added. Officers also reviewed surveillance tape from nearby businesses and did not find anything of evidentiary value. Contact Tony Reed at 217-421-7977 or follow him on Twitter at Tony J. Reed. From Decatur, Brendan Moore. New development director named. Lacey Elsey, a longtime city employee who most recently served as inaugural director of the Transportation Services Department, has been tapped by City Manager Tim Gleason to be the city's director of economic and community development. Elsey had been serving in the role on an interim basis since the April departure of Director Cordero Patrick, who joined the City of Bloomington as its Director of Community Impact and Enhancement. In a statement, Gleason said that Elsey has shown great leadership and commitment to the betterment of the organization and community during her time working for the city. He added at Monday's City Council meeting that picking Elsey was an easy decision for the very tough task that is community revitalization. She's always proven herself to be somebody that accomplishes the mission and is always very eager to take on more, Gleason said. Elsey has worked for the city since 2015. She was first a neighborhood program specialist in the department she now leads. In 2020, she moved over to the city manager's office, where she was first a grants manager and later the administrator of the Decatur Public Transit System, which runs 15 bus routes and a downtown trolley. In 2023, the City Council voted to make transit its own department, and former City Manager Scott Wrighton named Elsey its director. In the intervening years, Elsey has played a lead role in the transformation of the city's public transportation, which includes a transition from diesel-powered buses to hybrids, and eventually fully electric buses. Elsey has also worked to implement a streamlining of fixed bus routes and introduction of a first-mile, last-mile solution known as microtransit. This will entail branded vehicles taking riders from a designated stop near their homes to either stops near their final destinations or to fixed-route buses that could be used to complete their trips. Gleason announced at Monday's City Council meeting that the city has received its first microtransit vehicles. It is expected to be rolled out sometime this year. Elsey, speaking at the council meeting Monday evening, said she was honored to step back into the department where she got her start in city government. I'm excited for the opportunities ahead and the challenges that will come with that, and looking forward to all the work that we have to do together, she said. Elsey's task will be a tough one. Neighborhood revitalization has been the number one priority for the Decatur City Council since Gleason's first tenure as city manager. But the city still struggles to keep up with the spread of blight in the urban core. The city dedicated more than one-third of its $34 million federal American Rescue Plan funds to citywide revitalization initiatives such as demolitions, home rehabilitation programs, and rent utility assistance. This led to a record of 150 structures being demolished by the city in 2024. A $1.2 million donation from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation in 2020 helped in a targeted way by providing the resources for clearing abandoned homes in the Johns Hill neighborhood. But with private and federal funds dried up and no dedicated revenue stream, revitalization initiatives are now coming out of the city's general fund budget. Gleason included $2.7 million for revitalization efforts, including $1.5 million for demolitions, in his 25 city budget. So far, the city has demolished 0 properties in 25, despite there being 142 active demolition cases. By comparison, 52 structures had been leveled by this time last year. Gleason, who said that the city was underperforming in the economic development side and on the community development side, said that Elsey will make a presentation in June or July about what the community revitalization plan is with a very limited amount of resources. Elsey is a Decatur native who graduated from MacArthur High School, received her associate's degree from Richland Community College, and bachelor and master's degrees from Millikan University. Now from our opinion page, Hedging Their Bits. Opinion 1 from Keith Ammon. Ammon is a New Hampshire state legislator and lead sponsor of House Bill 302, a strategic Bitcoin reserve law. He wrote this for InsideSources.com. States protect finances by investing in Bitcoin. New Hampshire became the first state this month to authorize a strategic Bitcoin reserve. As the lead sponsor of this groundbreaking legislation, I'm proud that our state continues its tradition of being first in the nation, not just in presidential primaries, but also in fiscal innovation. The legislation allows the state treasurer to invest up to 5% of certain state-held funds in Bitcoin or precious metals, assets with a fixed supply that effectively hedges against inflation. This approach isn't about speculation, but prudent risk management in an era of unprecedented federal spending and monetary expansion. Consider the stark reality. As of May, the national debt has surpassed $36.2 trillion, according to U.S. Treasury data. The Congressional Budget Office projects that interest payments will reach $952 billion in 2025, exceeding the government's spending on Medicare and national defense, second only to Social Security. By 26, interest costs will reach $1 trillion, or about 3.5% of gross domestic product, eclipsing the previous high set in 1991. Nearly 40% of all U.S. dollars have been issued since 2020. This figure reflects the growth of the nation's money supply during and since the COVID-19 pandemic. The consequences of this inflationary monetary policy are felt by every American at the grocery store, in housing costs, and throughout our economy. States are inextricably tied to the dollar, yet public officials are responsible for protecting taxpayer funds from long-term devaluation caused by federal mismanagement. This is where Bitcoin and precious metals offer a potential solution. Gold has a 5,000-year history as a superior store of value. With its algorithmically fixed supply of 21 million units, Bitcoin functions as digital gold, with additional benefits. It's instantly verifiable, easily storable and transportable, and impossible to counterfeit. The two assets are complementary. The New Hampshire legislation sets strict guardrails. Digital assets must have a market capitalization of $500 billion, only Bitcoin now qualifies, and be held in secure U.S. regulated custody. Bitcoin and gold can reduce overall portfolio risk while improving long-term returns through diversification and regular rebalancing. Bitcoin experiences volatility, but it has averaged double-digit annual returns over the past decade. The 5% allocation maximum ensures limited exposure while providing meaningful inflation protection. Since exempting a virtual currency from the money transmitter regulations in 2017, New Hampshire has created legal frameworks for and proposed specialized court dockets for this emerging sector. The bipartisan support for the New Hampshire measure demonstrates this isn't a partisan issue. It's about sound money and fiscal responsibility. Citizens across the political spectrum are concerned about inflation and a lack of fiscal restraint in Washington. Precious metals and Bitcoin offer a decentralized, secure, non-political monetary system, precisely the hedge needed in uncertain times. As of March 16th, states had introduced similar legislation. Texas and Florida are moving quickly. Arizona has created a limited reserve for unclaimed crypto assets, and Oklahoma has nearly passed its version. Other states need not reinvent the wheel. The New Hampshire legislation provides a tested model, and organizations like the Satoshi Action Fund offer resources and model legislation. I invite my colleagues nationwide to join New Hampshire not for headlines, but to secure your state's financial future. History shows that governments drowning in debt invariably resort to printing more money and devaluing their currency through monetary debasement. This allows them to lessen the total value owed at the expense of citizens. No state can stop this train until it eventually runs out of track, but we can prepare by diversifying our reserves with assets designed to preserve value. New Hampshire has taken the first step. Will your state be next? From our food page, we have recipes for the upcoming Memorial Day weekend holiday. An all-beef hot dog topped with home chili sauce is an easy dish for your Memorial Day picnic. And we have a recipe for grind your own sirloin burgers. If you freeze the burgers before grilling, you'll get a better crust with a still tender interior. For the full recipe and instructions, see the in-print version of the Decatur Herald and Review. Now from our Nation and World page, from Washington, federal budget, Trump pushes holdouts. President tries to get GOP lawmakers to fall in line on spending bill. From the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. President Donald Trump implored House Republicans at the Capitol on Tuesday to drop their fights over his big tax cut bills, a multi-trillion dollar package that is at risk of collapsing before planned votes this week. During the more than hour-long session Tuesday, Trump warned Republicans not to touch Medicaid with cuts, and he told New York lawmakers to end their fight for a bigger local tax deduction, reversing his own campaign promise. The president, heading into the meeting, praised Speaker Mike Johnson, but he also criticized at least one of the GOP holdouts as a grandstander. Negotiations are slogging along, and it's not at all clear the package, with its sweeping tax breaks and cuts to Medicaid, food stamps, and green energy programs, has the support needed from the House's slim majority, Republican majority. Lawmakers are also being asked to add some $350 billion to Trump's border security, deportation, and defense agenda. Inside, he spoke privately in what one lawmaker called the president's weaving style and took questions. The president also made it clear he's losing patience with the various holdout factions of the House Republicans, according to a senior White House official who spoke on condition of anonymity. It was not at all clear that Trump changed minds. "We're still a long ways away," said Representative Andy Harris, Republican Maryland, the chair of the House Freedom Caucus. "Conservatives insist on quicker, steeper cuts to federal programs to offset the costs of the trillions of dollars in lost tax revenue." At the same time, a core group of lawmakers from New York and other high-tax states want bigger tax breaks for their voters back home. Worries about piling onto the nation's $36 trillion debt are stark. With House Democrats lined up against the package as a giveaway to the wealthy at the expense of the safety net programs, GOP leaders have almost no votes to spare. A key committee hearing was scheduled for the middle of the night Tuesday, in hopes of a House floor vote by Wednesday afternoon. They literally are trying to take health care away from millions of Americans at this very moment in the dead of the night, said House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan fiscal watchdog group, estimates that the House bill is shaping up to add about $3.3 trillion to the debt over the next decade. Again from the Associated Press in Washington, D.C., administration to limit vaccines. New Trump policy will narrow shot access to those deemed high risk. The Trump administration said Tuesday it will limit approval for seasonal COVID-19 shots to seniors and others at high risk pending more data on everyone else, raising questions about whether some people who want to get a vaccine this fall will be able to get one. Top officials for the Food and Drug Administration laid out new requirements for access to updated COVID shots, saying they'd continue to use a streamlined approach to make them available to adults 65 and older, as well as children and younger adults with at least one high-risk health problem. But the FDA framework, published Tuesday in the New England Journal of Medicine, urges companies to conduct large, lengthy studies before tweaked vaccines can be approved for healthier people. It's unclear what the upcoming changes mean for people who may still want a fall COVID-19 shot, but don't clearly fit into one of the categories. Is the pharmacist going to determine if you're in a high-risk group? Asked Dr. Paul Offit, a vaccine expert at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The only thing that can come of this will make vaccines less insurable and less available. The nation's leading pediatrics group said FDA's approach will limit options for parents and their children. If the vaccine were no longer available or covered by insurance, it will take the choice away from families who wish to protect their children from COVID-19, said Dr. Sean O'Leary of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Meanwhile, Tuesday, World Health Organization member countries approved an agreement to better prevent, prepare for, and respond to future pandemics in the wake of the devastation wrought by the coronavirus. Sustained applause echoed in a Geneva hall hosting the WHO's annual assembly as the measure debated and devised over the course of 3 years passed without opposition. The U.S., traditionally the top donor to the UN Health Agency, didn't send a representative after the Trump administration announced a U.S. pullout from the WHO. While many supporters praised the historic deal, U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. delivered a scathing critique of the UN Health Agency, saying via video the United States was working with unspecified, like-minded countries to improve the global health system, and called on health ministers and others to join. U.S. appears to deport immigrants to South Sudan. Court order prohibits administration from sending people away. Associated Press, Washington. The Trump administration appears to have begun deporting people from Myanmar and Vietnam to South Sudan, despite a court order restricting removals to other countries, attorneys for the migrants said in court documents. Immigration authorities might have sent up to a dozen people from several countries to Africa, they told a judge. These removals would violate a court order saying people must get a meaningful opportunity to argue that sending them to a country outside their homeland would threaten their safety, attorneys said. The apparent removal was one man from Myanmar was confirmed in an email from an immigration official in Texas, according to court documents. He was informed only in English, a language he does not speak well, they said. A woman also reported that her husband from Vietnam and up to 10 other people were flown to Africa Tuesday morning, attorneys from the National Immigration Litigation Alliance wrote. The Department of Homeland Security and the White House did not immediately return messages seeking comment. Now from the Nation and World Digest. Authorities accuse Rep of pushing and grabbing. Federal prosecutors allege Democratic Representative LaMonica McIver of New Jersey pushed and grabbed officers while trying to block the arrest of the Newark mayor outside an immigration detention facility, according to court papers unsealed Tuesday. In an 8-page complaint, interim U.S. Attorney Alina Haba's office said McIver was objecting to the removal of Newark Mayor Ross Baraka from a congressional tour of the Delaney Hall Detention Center in Newark on May 9th. Haba charged Baraka with trespassing after his arrest, but dismissed the allegation Monday when she said in a social media post she will instead charge the congresswoman. From World News Briefly, Ukraine War. Kyiv's European allies slapped new sanctions Tuesday on Moscow, a day after a phone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin failed to produce a breakthrough on ending the 3-year-old war in Ukraine. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, May 21st. Please stay tuned.